This episode is sponsored by Claude, the AI for minds that don't stop at good enough. This is Pretty Much Pop, a culture podcast, a bad camp for bad people. Today we're discussing Lord of the Flies, the William Golding novel published in 1952 in light of the new BBC version, written by Jack Thorne. I'm Mark Lintzenmeyer, and sucks to your ass, Ma!
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm Al Baker, happier than usual to be a vegetarian.
You're a vegetarian. I never knew that, Al. Well, you're a vegetarian?
We're all learning.
I have no idea.
I'm Sarah Lynn Breck, and we all know who the real Lord of the Flies is. The YKK Company, the world's largest and dominant zipper manufacturer. Produced in Japan, they produce 40 to 50% of the global zipper supply. Odds are pretty good you're wearing one of their flies now.
Joke's on you, Sarah, because I haven't got out of my pajamas today.
And I have on sweatpants. This is Lawrence Ware in the last group project that I was in charge of went so badly it ended up like Lord of the Flies.
Well, this was a nice surprise that I didn't know that was coming that jumped up on Netflix, and we were already talking about a Survivor episode, which we're still going to do, but this is not that. I mean, we'll discuss it at the end. And I was thinking, you know, this might be a general sort of desert island novels, films, whatever. But there's actually quite a lot to talk about just with Lord of the Flies. I mean, it is like one of the philosophy 101 novels that we are probably all forced to read in school. And I enjoyed this new version. There are two previous film versions that I watched parts of. And just the ability to direct kids seems to have advanced. So I'm just for that reason, I like this new version quite a bit better. Should we go around the horn?
Traditionally, I go first in these roundtables, but I don't have very strong feelings about this show. The thing is, Lord of the Flies is such a great story. And I think the best thing that you can say for this TV show is that it really made me feel like I was watching a very faithful adaptation of the book. I remember reading it for the first time when, yeah, I was made to read it in school, but because I was a precocious little shit, I read it a few years before I was forced to read it at school. And I remember being like impressed and deeply disturbed as a 12-year-old, especially the final scene that always really stuck with me when the adult turns up and everybody is faced with the stark reality of everything that's happened. And I just finished watching the show this afternoon, and that particular scene, again, really stuck with me. All of the things I remember being struck by the book were there in the show and struck me more or less exactly the same way. So I think really the big takeaway is this is just a really terrific job and an adaptation of a really good story. And it's obviously timely for all the reasons that we're inevitably going to talk about. But it lands the brief precisely because it's doing a terrific job at a faithful adaptation at exactly the right moment. And I think it's really strong bit of work.
I read this just like most people did in middle school, and I didn't really give too much thought about the book for most of my adult life until my husband taught it many years ago when he was teaching in California. And I picked it up again and I read it as an adult. And it's one of those books that it doesn't read necessarily differently as an adult. I think it hit me in lots of the same ways as it did when I was a kid. But I think there was definitely more nuance. I think there was definitely, as an adult, I felt more sympathy or empathy toward the children in this book. Whereas I think when I was a 12-year-old, I really, really hated Jack. I just hated that character so much. It was fun to be able to revisit the story in this form on Netflix through the BBC and see their take on it and be able to really kind of compare how they told this story that everyone knows so well and be able to kind of come up with more stuff from it. It was really interesting because we really got to get into the heads of the different characters, which is not what the book does. The book is very much, it's third person. It's mostly told from Ralph's point of view. And it was fun to be able to watch that and be able to get into the heads of these characters a little bit more. So I enjoyed it. And I feel like this is a conversation surrounding the story that we've been having for the past, 80 years or something close to?
Okay. Of course, the book is a classic. Enjoyed the book. I think I read the book when I was 10 years old, probably a little too young to read it. But I was very much like Al, a precocious little shit. And so I was just reading everything. I remember I read Ender's Game way too young as well. I was reading a whole bunch of different things. Anyway, I read that. Honestly, I just read it and finished it. It didn't really make much of an impact on me when I first read it. Revisiting it as a college student really left an impact on me. So I really enjoyed the story. The story is very impactful. I didn't love the TV show, guys. So let me start off by saying it's not a bad TV show. It's not poorly made. The direction is great. The acting is so much better. But it's just something about the pace of it, the interiority of the characters. It just didn't work for me on some level. It was way too ethereal, cutting away to naturalistic shots and rain falling or something like that. I never really enjoyed that kind of storytelling. So it's just a personal thing. But as far as the story of the show, it's very faithful. It's quite good. It just felt like it kind of dragged in some places where it didn't need to drag. It's something that I think could have been easily one of those 3-episode British things, or maybe even a 2-episode thing, and they kind of drag it out to 4 episodes. But that's not to say don't watch it. I think it's quite good. You should watch it. Just, I would have preferred for the pacing to kind of pick up a little bit more, but that's a personal preference.
So let me add that I listened this morning to the NPR Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, which devoted a whole 18-minute episode to this. It includes commercials.
Some of those are my friends.
Very much a drive-by, and they all had very kind of negative takes on it. Like one was like, yeah, oh, it's a sanitized Spielberg. Like, I didn't see that at all. I thought that even just the soundtrack alone
made it
like the soundtrack was very White Lotus in terms of just like weird dissonant 20th century stuff. Very atmospheric, wonderfully shot. And then people were insulted on that show by just bad memories from middle school of this is what symbolism is. Look, the conch represents civilization. And, you know, and I just didn't, and I didn't care about that.
There is some of that. There's some of that. Yeah, there is some of that.
This is what I was going to say about Lawrence's reaction. Because, yeah, some of the stuff that I liked about the show was that they really lent into literariness isn't quite the right word, because you can do literariness without doing like big pathetic fallacy symbolism on the TV. But I think the story really suits it. The reason that you learn it in middle school is because it's really easy to point at that story and see what the allegories are and see what the metaphors are and how they're working. So I think the adaptation leaning into that really, really suits it. Although I do absolutely see there are points where the metaphors get in the way of the pacing of the story a little bit, but that's a fine trade-off for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree that the show, each episode, I like that it was divided into 4 episodes, but I think we could have shaved off maybe 15 minutes or something for each. It did take a long time. I don't know how much time we needed looking directly into children's faces, for example. Like we saw that shot a lot over and over and over again. And I felt like sometimes it was just sort of hammering things in that were very obvious, or that they could have just done once and that would have been enough. But as far as the symbolism, I feel like the book is, you know, just like you said, Al, it's actually great. It's a great introduction to allegory and symbolism for kids. And the book, the characters, almost all are, those 4 characters are symbols. Mm. And what I liked or appreciated about the television show is that they really got to get into the characters and give us these 3-dimensional human beings. Piggy even gets a name. You know, I actually really appreciated being able to get to know these characters more and exploring their experience in this particular world.
The development of Jack feels like really the biggest thing that you get out there. And then you get to center Simon as kind of the bridge between Ralph and Jack too.
Yep.
What I think is admirable about that choice in particular is they found a way to do it without breaking the allegory, like the core of the allegory. Because you're right, Jack in the book, when you read it, he's just the enemy. If you're an adult reader, like fully contextualizing the fact that these are children, then you might have a different view of him. But the show really goes above and beyond to give you the explanation for kind of why Jack is behaving this way, and doesn't let you off as easily as the book does. You don't get to just write Jack off as a little asshole, even though he is clearly a little asshole.
He is a little asshole.
Well, and I saw at the end that the actor that played Jack is in the Harry Potter series that
of course.
He is,
yeah,
the bad.
Was he Draco? He is Draco.
Yeah, he's Draco. Yeah,
like, all right, that checks.
That's great casting.
Yeah,
that it's checks perfect. Out. I know. My initial take was like, he is giving such Slytherin vibes right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was what we're looking for. If this is a Jack Thorne adolescence, we all really like the adolescence miniseries. Mm-hmm. And part of that, not that it like had a lot of scenes with the kid before the murder with his friends. And, you know, it's sort of a after the fact autopsy of that. But we're looking for how psychologically astute this portrayal of the Jack character in particular. I mean, I think in general, how nice kids get riled up, you know, get turned evil. But in particular, his just ego issues and his, I'll be nice to you in private, but then I have to put on a mm-hmm. front. And anytime mm-hmm. my competent, I can't, you know, deal with anybody saying that I failed at something. Whereas even in the book, it's just like they say, he says literally like anytime Jack was not in charge, he lost interest. Like that's just his mm-hmm. personality, where it just was so much better. I think the treatment of Jack and also of Simon, mm-hmm. you know, that there, I think that would be a thing. Okay. He represents the spiritual, but the attitudes in 1954 about spirituality and what that means are quite different than now. So what does that mean for this character? And he was just so much more fully developed. And I guess they're all prepubescent. Like, is Simon gay? You know, just the whole homoeroticism of the whole thing.
I think that's mm-hmm. very clear. Yeah. He is. Yeah.
I didn't pick up as him being gay in the book. Maybe on the show, definitely.
Right.
No, not in the book. But
he's underdeveloped in the book. He's just sort of a cipher.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I did enjoy the fact that they gave the characters more interiority and more, a little bit more, you know, explanatory. Sarah, my question is for you. Are writers still doing symbolism like this, the way they were doing like Animal Farm and this book? Are they still doing symbolism like this? Because I haven't read anything that's like this symbolic in a while.
Sure. Off the top of my head, I mean, literary fiction tends to lean more heavily into symbolism and character development too. But more literary fiction will be doing that. But the fiction that is at the top of the New York Times is not allegorical in any way. Pretty
it's
much, just murder. It's pretty obvious.
It's a whole bunch of murder is what's at the top of the
and romance. There's kissing and guns, right?
I feel like a modern book might have more trouble avoiding just having a discussion, an explicit discussion about the themes involved, instead of just somehow having an obvious, oh, this is the Christ figure, because it's just been done so many times. Mm-hmm. So instead, let's like have one of the characters say, oh, you're playing the Christ figure, are you? Or, you know, so like just actually say
the subtext, right? Yeah.
This is really interesting because that's kind of postmodern, right? Just having that discussion. And that was going to be my follow-up for Sarah, like the allegory. So, yeah, like literary fiction still uses metaphor and allegory, but an allegorical story in the Lord of the Flies sense feels like old-fashioned in a lot of ways. And it feels like having too much mm-hmm. of a clear allegory in your story, that feels like something that a critic nowadays would have a go at someone for.
100%.
I can think of that in the TV shows. So, yeah, it's...
This seems far more modern because of the way that it's told. The television show seems far more modern because of the way it's told. So it is doing like that multiple point of view. So in the book, it is told third person. It's not really close. It's more omniscient, but we're with Ralph the entire time. But we don't necessarily know. We have to kind of interpret what he's feeling. And that also seems to be secondary. Whereas in this modern retelling, we're giving Piggy agency. Piggy has agency in this book. He's not just annoying. He is annoying, but he's also has ideas. He's making plans. He's making actions. He's doing something for the story. He is part of the story in a way that is more than he was in the novel. And I think that there are some changes that don't really jibe with the original story. For example, I think Ralph wasn't very nice to Piggy, and he wasn't always nice to Piggy in the television show either, but he's so much nicer to him. They're really kind of partners in this in lots of ways, where Piggy wasn't that at all. He was definitely still seen as less than, even though he was this voice of reason.
Well, and that nice scene of Piggy singing and Simon, who, you know, is in the choir, can actually sing. That's just a nice little scene. It's not, it's nothing to do with the book.
It was a nice scene. Yeah,
yeah, but even just the use of Piggy and even just calling him that, I feel icky, like I'm participating in this, that I want to just refer to the character as Nikki, because mm-hmm. that is something that you just feel like in the 50s, kids were maybe more casually cruel and there was more of a buttoned up, you know, we're not quite as back as Peaky Blinders, but still a notion of manhood that you just dismiss beneath contempt, the people that, you know, whereas now, okay, there's still bullies, but there is also a notion people have been taught a lot more about compassion. And so you can understand, I think Ralph was sort of modernized.
Hmm.
Yes, he's going to be thoughtless. He's still going to convey. It became like a challenge in the script of like, how is Ralph going to be the one that tells everybody that this kid is named Piggy when he's fundamentally not a dick?
Mm-hmm.
But yet, I think, you know, I think they did okay with that. I think they, just the calling him that at all, and the way, because the book is not sympathetic. It introduces him as an enormously fat boy. They actually switch when after Simon, spoiler, there's going to be spoilers, okay. You guys know the story.
Spoilers for a 100-year-old book.
Yeah. after Simon dies in the book, it is Piggy who's like, well, he shouldn't have been creeping around on his hands and knees. And Ralph is defending that. And they switch that around so that Piggy can be the continuous voice of conscience.
Mm.
Let's stop for sponsor messages. I want to tell you about Claude AI. The new version is scarily good, and I have been using it for several things. Here's a great example. When you want one piece of technology to talk to another piece of technology, how do you figure out how to do that? The manual, for one, is not going to list things specific about the other. So I have two sound cards I was trying to hook up. I got to tell it what software I was using, what OS I was using, all the things that I specifically needed out of the connection. And it just walked me right through it, troubleshooting with me. Claude is the AI for minds that don't stop at good enough. It's the collaborator that actually understands your entire workflow and thinks with you. Whether you're debugging code at midnight or strategizing your next business move, Claude extends your thinking to tackle the problems that matter. Okay, first, you might wonder, why do I need Claude? Why don't I just do a web search? In fact, there's AI built into web searching right now. Well, Claude's capabilities go deeper than basic web search, giving you comprehensive, reliable analysis with proper citations. And it's going to give you outputs that are not just rough drafts that you have to fix up, but publication-ready documents, spreadsheets, presentations using the templates you want. With Claude, you can build interactive tools and apps, right? You just describe what you need. I recently needed a master spreadsheet that would, on an ongoing basis, combine the contents of several other spreadsheets. And Claude just generated some code to do that. Claude connects to your professional tools, GitHub, Jira, HubSpot, Notion, Google Workspace. It can run tasks in the background while you do other things. You can schedule tasks. You can send tasks from your phone to your laptop. Claude has access to all of your files and tools. There is a reason that companies like Stripe, Shopify, and Pfizer trust Anthropic with the rollout of AI in their businesses. For problems worth solving, get started with Claude at claude.ai/PMP. That's claude.ai/PMP, and check out Claude Pro, which includes access to all the features mentioned in today's episode, claude.ai/PMP.
I'm going to say something controversial. And listen, for the record, I was not a bully when I was in high school and middle school. I don't think that Piggy should have been killed, but that kid really annoyed the hell out of me. Like, he really annoyed the hell out of me. And when I was a young person, he's the kind of kid, I would not have bullied him, but I would, like, definitely not have hung around him. I'd have definitely taken a wide berth whenever I was coming across him. And so my question to you guys, does that make me a bad person? I don't know how to feel about myself, guys. Like, talk to me. Help me out here.
Yeah, I mean, all I can tell you is that I was on Piggy's side the whole time. He did nothing wrong. Ralph did his best.
But he was annoying. What?
He's a cruel and morally bad person. Getting back to the allegory for a moment, this is something that I think that, and is on the specific point of like the cruelty of the kids, and this is something that the show handles really well, I think, from the novel. One of the things I think the show is trying to say or make more explicit is that the civilization which the boys are clinging on to is rooted in a very important way in casual cruelty. The cruelty is what remains once the kind of trappings have left. And that's one of the obvious themes, because it's, you know, British colonialism British ruling classes and all of that kind of stuff. But in the show, we get to have, again, in the character development of Jack, we get to see a lot more about like the relationship that he's had with his father and obviously that his history with Simon and all that kind of stuff. It really informs, so the fact that Jack picks people up and then gets what he needs from them and then turns his back on them. Mm-hmm. In the book, that's just Jack being only interested when he's the center of attention. But in the TV show, it's much more about this is Jack behaving rationally in the kind of cutthroat social environment that he exists in. And that's a much more, as you said, Sarah, a much more kind of modern take on what the allegory is kind of pressing on.
You know, I'm glad that you brought that up because of that whole grown-ups equal civilization, right? And for some, civilization is a source of security. So Piggy and his relationship with his aunt was a source of comfort for him and security. And so that's why I think he sees so much. He really wants rules. He wants people to follow the rules because that will make them safe and that will make sure that the grownups come and save them. Whereas Jack doesn't feel that way. He has to lie about who his father is. He has to lie about his background. And he clearly doesn't see the same kind of comfort and security in civilization or what grownups represent for him. Actually, not even represent, they just, that's who they are in his life. And I thought that the show did a really good job of connecting those dots for us. And it really actually pulled, I think it pulls the audience in even more.
What do we think about the shift where Simon says, like, there's nowhere I'd rather be than here, that I'm happy. You know, we can say Jack also didn't really have anything to go back to. And this is, at least he gets to have his little fiefdom here. But this is the thing. Simon saying that, that's what makes them say, oh, you're baddie, and sort of write him off. The good characters are saying this because that is a kind of a crazy thing to say. Like, of course, we want to go back to civilization, but it is one of the tropes. And Al, you brought up this Send Help movie. You know, are you going to go native and say, you know what? Let's just stay here. Let's live in our little fantasy world. The weather's so nice. We have so many nice overhead shots of this beautiful island. Like so it's one of the ideas on the table, but you know, it never is explicitly stated in the book or something like that.
Honestly, I don't remember it. Why did he want to stay? That is a weird thing to say.
I mean, I think it's because like Jack, you know, they were the ones that were left at school because they didn't really have parents that cared about them.
Yes, you're right. Yeah, yeah.
And he could be who he wanted to be. He could just be himself. Mm. Simon could.
Another big change, right, in my little intro, a bad camp for bad people. That was not, I think that was the quote from the film, but that was not in the book. In fact, Ralph totally participated in the frenzied killing of Simon. He was into it and Piggy was there. I don't know that he was right on the front line participating, but like they made a hard cut between the people that had been influenced by Jack and were jumping around and with their masks and things, and these characters that were still sane, that were aware of what was going on at the time.
That is a really good thing to point out. Does that massively undercut the whole point of the story? Does it make it us and them? Because I did think when he said the line about this is a bad camp for bad people, I was like, obviously that's not from Golding. I don't remember the book well enough, but you know, that's a modern line. I was like, oh, this is coming. I was like, I see what you're doing here, and this is about polarization and whatnot. And like, I see it. It's not quite over the line, but you're getting close to an anachronistic political reading of the text here. And hearing you point that out makes me think: is that a really awful choice? If we're saying that, if you can be the sensible, is this show now saying that is Ralph's position in this show that if you maintain the moderate, sensible leadership position, you know, plus a degree of competence and respect that Ralph lacked, that you're going to be immune from the forces that turn everyone else into a barbarian? Because that doesn't seem right.
I mean, it seems like he was willing in the show to submit. Like, look, I give up. Not that I'll become a savage, whatever, but like, I'll acknowledge your leadership. Like, what other choice do I have? Like, you are I want to stay alive and not hide in the woods all the time. Mm-hmm. It seems like if the fascist is in power, unless you just kill yourself, which, you know, you could get saved anytime, then this is very rational. I'm okay with the clear us versus them distinction because I think it was focused more on making, and I'll even defend the length of the whole thing, And I wonder what it would actually be like. You know, Lauren, show this to your kids or something. Did you watch? You didn't watch this with your kids, I assume?
Absolutely not. No. Well, one of them got to graduate, so I haven't had time to do anything like that.
If this was actually your first introduction to the story, taking it a little slow and trying to make it reasonable that, you know, just you gradually sacrifice parts of your civilized humanity until you become this thing. Whereas if it's an hour and a half film, like 1963 version, like you're getting there pretty fast.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say it needs to be an hour and a half, but like 2 hours and 30 minutes, something like that. It's just, it didn't need to be this long was my main criticism. But I do think that there's something to be said for the pacing and the intentionality of the pacing and showing that you slowly lose parts of your humanity. You're right that is narratively interesting. I just didn't know if it needed to be this slow. But yeah, I hear what you're saying on that point.
I wonder if you're also not supposed to binge it, right? Sarah, you were saying, I think somebody was saying that you shouldn't have this many scenes of the face.
That could be true.
If it's happening in different episodes and you were actually watching it on different weeks, like maybe that was the intention, that it's sort of reintroducing these themes. But I feel like there's something that this is taking off, like the faces of the dispossessed or something. Look how horrible things are in Gaza, in starving Africa, in poor Appalachia. And you show poor child, you know, and look deep into their eyes, right? That very famous.
That's true.
And actually kind of wrong picture of like a 13-year-old African girl or something. But then it like became an international icon. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about here, but there's
a National Geographic.
She has like very deep. Yes. Mm-hmm. And she has
National Geographic
blue eyes.
I remember
she kind of came out in the last 5 years, like objecting to like her use of this picture. And like, you know, I was 13 and this is gross and I was never paid for that. Anyway, it's this kind of, I don't want to say child pornography. It's certainly not that, but like it is you know, the way we use suffering porn or. But it is, you know, like we're going to, as an artist, right? If you want to, as a photographer, as an artist, really show the humanity of people, then you show them kind of dirty and you show them where you can like connect as if you were looking into the eyes of another human being. And I think this was really effective like that. I don't know that I needed to see quite as much of the back of kids' necks as they walk around their dirty necks. It did seem like it was doing something, presenting the physical form of these kids as an object of artistic contemplation.
On a slightly less intellectual level, I really enjoyed long lingering shots of the goofy looking kid faces that we had.
Goofy kids, Al.
5-6 seconds. There was that one particular tiny little blonde kid.
Percy.
I can't remember what his character name was. Percy. I really enjoyed the lingering shots of Percy.
Would you kick Percy if you saw him walking around?
Because that is bully. I would buy him a bag of sweets and watch him eat them.
That's not weird at all. What are you doing?
Because he just looks like he'd gobble them all up. I mean, to make a slightly more serious point, the kids were all terrific. They were brilliantly cast, not just because they could all act. Mark said this right at the beginning. Clearly, drama schools are better now than they used to be. But the way the kids all looked as well was really great. Like, they didn't all look the same, but they were all capable of that, like, real doe-eyed, gaunt, sad expression that you were talking about, Mark. Uh-huh. They all looked great once they dirtied themselves up.
And they were little. I mean, they were, like, 6-year-olds. You know, I mean, it seemed like all of the kids, I think the four principal characters, I think those are all... I'm guessing those are all established actors, or they all have acting experience. But I think the bulk of the cast, they didn't have acting experience. You're right. They looked like kids. They didn't look like kids, you know, like if you're watching a high school show about high schoolers, you know that they're all like 28 years old. You know, these are kids that look like kids because they are kids. And I thought that was really effective. And I also kind of applauded that effort. It could not have been easy to direct those kids, but they did a wonderful job. And I thought what showed up on screen was really striking.
Imagine being a kid on that shoot. How much fun.
No, that seems like a great time.
Were you able to watch the making of?
Because presumably they just all went and had like a holiday camp for a month.
Oh, no, I didn't watch the making of. Did you watch the making of that, Mark?
No,
just,
I didn't.
Just the beginning of it, because it, like, when I finished it, it was like, in the Netflix Lord of the Flies collection, there are two things, right? And here's the making of is the second thing. I saw the beginning of it. It was pretty long, but I was just kind of surprised just seeing like the kids are on the boat. And okay, here they have to have schooling on set, and they just look like happy little kids, you know?
Yeah, they look, I'm sure they did. I was really taken aback because I've read the book and I knew that the book said that they were kids, and I've seen the movies, and yeah, they're kids in the movies, but it really didn't hit me. Watching this show, it really hit me. They're kids. Like, they're really legitimate kids, like young kids, little kids. And the main characters, they themselves are little shits. They don't know anything. They're kids. And it really hit for me just how young they were. And it made me wonder, on some level, the writer of the original book, Golding, the kids are susceptible to this. And I guess the intention is to say that adults are also susceptible to this kind of violence, is kind of what's going on. But it made me wonder, is that really true? Is it really true that adults are as susceptible to violence as the kids show themselves to be in this show and in this book? And my inclination is to say yes, but I want to know what you guys thought about that, because that is what is the intention of the writer, but is he right on that point? Is he right that adults are as susceptible to that violence? Because when you're talking about kids, kids are young, they're very impressionable, whatever. Are we that dopey? Are we that susceptible to this?
I think the point that Golding is trying to make is that while we might think that grown-ups... why did you choose children, right? If you'd chosen grown-ups, there are all kinds of plausible reasons why an island full of grown-ups would devolve into barbarism, because they have self-interest and they're not innocent, basically. Kids are innocent. And it's not an accident either that these are the kinds of kids they are. These are kids that come from public schools in Britain.
So privileged.
Not just privilege. They are the scions of empire.
Right.
They are the latest sons of the British Empire. They are born to rule. They have innocence molded by empire. In my view, Golding chooses these people because the point is exactly that these are the two things which we think protect us from kind of Hobbesian forces. Moral purity, so innocence, and the kind of civilizational values that Britain espoused at the time and continues to now. And Golding, I think, wants to show these things don't guarantee your safety, they guarantee the reverse. So yeah, that's my view.
And Golding, not only was he a teacher, so he taught kids and he knew kids, he knew that kids could be shits. He also served in World War II. And so he knew and believed, I think, very strongly that kind of evil is not from the outside. That comes from within all of us. And that potential is there in every single one of us. Even the people who we think of as the best of the best, he knows that actually, and that maybe even ingrows even more in people who consider themselves as leaders, as the best of the best of society. He definitely sees that not just in grownups, but also he sees this is something that is just sort of inherent in all of us. Personally, I don't agree with that, but I think that he fully believes that.
I don't think it's quite the kind of cynical point. It's more or less, it's a pretty cynical book, I guess. But something I wanted to pick up on was, you mentioned he wrote it right after World War II, sorry, which is obviously absolutely right. And one of the super important parts about that is obviously the prevailing kind of geopolitical culture at the time had it that the Axis powers were morally deficient compared to the morally superior Western powers. And obviously they were politically deficient in a number of ways. And I think Golding here is also trying to say that that's not a helpful attitude to have. And he's looking at specifically British values, you know, which were at the time being lauded as the thing that had led to the vanquishing of Nazism, and showed that that can also lead to the same kind of cruelty, which, you know, we're now so confident that it inoculates us against.
Mm-hmm. I probably still have the paperback, the version that I read in school, but it had an afterword. I'm Googling now. I don't think it was written by Golding himself, though he did write an afterword you know, in a, some short thing, but it just straight up told you like, hey, the adults picked them up, but the adults are involved in World War II. They're in a war at the time. And this just, this is a symbol for how the island, because there is no authority figure, is just like the world. This is Hobbes's point, right? That we have a Leviathan within a state, but we don't have a world Leviathan. So we're going to have chaos. But that doesn't actually answer Lawrence's question, because the way in which people go war crazy, adults sign on for, yes, bomb the shit out of them. There's something, whether you're, you know, as we are now, sitting back thousands of miles away from the action, or even if you're, let's all join the army as they were at the time, it's a different way of going crazy. It, you know, obviously, if you're in the military, you have military discipline, and that's why they think they're so superior, even if they're doing something that is fundamentally evil.
Inhumane, yeah.
So it's a little different than breaking down and putting on a mask so you can dissociate from your own humanity. Although maybe that's, you know, putting on a military uniform. I'm now not acting as a moral agent. I'm acting as an agent of the crown.
Of the state. Yeah, good point.
There's an interesting bit in the TV show, and I can't remember if there's this analog in the book, but I think the second or third episode where Jack is, they finally killed the pig, but in the process they let the fire go out. And there's this argument, and Jack says, like, we killed the pig, so, you know, you should thank us. And Ralph said, like, that was your job. Like, that doesn't make you special. That really stood out to me as an interesting comment, or a sharpening of a comment, about the role of the military in a civilization. This is a kind of fatuous way of putting it, but, like, what you signed up for is dangerous and important, but ultimately it's the job that you signed up for the betterance of the civilization as a whole. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't privilege you over the people who signed up to, you know, do the other vitally important work, building the shelters, farming, tending people, nursing, you know, looking after children, whatever. What you were saying, Mark, about the military kind of made me think of that, because the afterword that you just quoted was fatuous and stupid, because I don't think Golding's making a anti-military point, because the point is precisely that what the kid loses their discipline, and that's where it all goes wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like do we have anything else to say about the Hobbesian message in here?
I mean, Hobbes has been done to death, both in this and very other many ways. But I was surprised to learn that this had been banned in many different school districts, because I remember it being very much pushed to when I was younger. So I was surprised that it was banned. But, they'll ban.
On what grounds? Like, it's going to encourage kids to be violent? It's going to...
The summary is violence and disturbing content, profanity, sexual references, perceived anti-religious themes, and the book's bleak view of human nature. But I don't know. They'll ban anything these days. I think this is a very important book. And the whole banning thing, they need to kind of chill out with it. They've been banning things a whole bunch these days. We need to kind of chill out with that. We're going the Nazi route with all these bannings.
I mean, it is about kids. I don't think it sexualizes the kids at all.
No.
But I think that it invites you to contemplate them, their bodies, their souls. And that's not a thing that we as a culture are comfortable with, even with adults, much less with kids. Right. Because, everybody's a pedo. You know, that's the main political attack on both sides from, you know, the conspiracy theorists. So, like, the fact that this is doing it all, I could see this being condemned for exactly that reason.
Is it because then it's a story that dares to take kids seriously? Is that why we ban books that dares to take kids seriously? Okay, great.
Maybe.
I don't know if I agree with you, Sarah. I mean, it does take kids seriously, but like...
Yeah.
Let's back up for a second. Do you guys really think that kids would behave like this in this kind of situation? Like, do you guys really think, or is this the author putting into kids something that he wants to put into them for the sake of an analogy or telling a compelling story or something like that? Good story, but like, I never for a moment thought that a kids would devolve into this. Even when I was younger and reading this, I never for a moment thought kids would devolve into this. I thought it was a compelling story, but I never thought it would actually happen. Al, do you disagree? Do you agree? What do you think?
I just don't think that's the right kind of question to ask. Like, why does it matter if kids, the book isn't a warning about making sure that children on school trips are properly chaperoned.
I feel like we have raised this issue before in sort of bullying context. Maybe it was before your time, talking about Cobra Kai and things like that, where there's a certain kind of bullying that's sort of within, it's safe. But in the really disturbing films and shows about bullying, somebody could die. The bullies are really bad. And it's like they have life and
death. Especially in the 80s. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, they have life and death stakes. Mm-hmm. I do feel like if there really is no supervision and there is no punishment for wrongdoing, that some of these things could easily escalate. And, you know, just think of these gang fights, West Side Story. Like, people get knifed.
The point of the novel, precisely, that if you took away, like, the elements of civilization, like the prospect of one day being punished, why would you expect adults to act any differently?
But that's my point about the banning books. So I never took seriously that it would happen. And so it doesn't make any sense to me to ban the book. It's not like the people are going to be reading this book. I'm like, yeah, let's go out there and let's do this. Like, I never thought that was necessary.
I, for one, am very much in favor of banning literary classics, I think.
it ups their sales. So, you know, you should just a little bit.
It was crazy. They banned Stephen King in my school district.
Don't ban Stephen King. Just ban the good books.
Shots fired. Oh, wow.
I'm only talking about it.
It was actually the one that they banned.
Stephen King has basically banned his own book about that early Bachman one about the kid like holding up his school and shooting the teacher.
I thought it was a short story.
No, it's one of the Bachman novels.
Was it a novella? Yeah.
Oh, okay. It's a novella, but it's, you know, the kind of thing that has happened too often. So he's just like, we're not reprinting that one. That's, we have enough.
We can take that off.
He was ahead of his time.
I wondered if anybody had any thoughts about the casting. Like, Ralph is biracial. The kids are of different races.
I loved it. I thought it was wonderful.
Yeah, I like race-blind casting, but I wondered if this is a story that's set in 1953. It just seemed like no one acknowledged it. And it didn't really bother me, but I was like, no one's acknowledging that he's biracial. And whereas Piggy was mercilessly picked on for wearing glasses and being fat. And I thought, oh gosh, I wonder in the 1950s, would he have been picked on? I don't know. I thought the kid did a great job, but it was just, anyway, it was different from the book. And it was a big difference, actually.
I was reading into when Ralph was like, Jack had said, I should be chief. Ralph was like, oh, well, I want to be chief. And Jack is like, of course you do. Like, I was reading a whole class race thing in that.
I mean, there's definitely supposed
to be a class, like I'm head boy, where for some reason just being in the choir.
Yeah.
Right.
So a British upper class thing. We haven't really talked about the Britishness of this. And I didn't realize that the 1991 version, which is free on YouTube, so I watched the beginning of it, it's American. They're Americans and they're bad actors. And actually there's an adult there who's unconscious on the island. And I don't remember if it like ends by that guy waking up or if he eventually dies. Anyway, it seemed wrong in so many ways. And partly it's like they're military school boys. So they're like, oh, Ralph should be chief because he's the colonel. Like in military school, somehow you're a colonel. What the fuck is this?
You do get rank in military school. Yeah.
But so that was their substitution, I guess, for there's the British upper class. And Piggy's mom, you know, aunt works at a sweet shop and Ralph's dad is maybe an enlisted, right? Ellie, we're talking about this in terms of Peaky Blinders and the two different kinds of officers and things. Like, I was reading that into this.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And I think this speaks really nicely to the racial blindness casting point. The fact that it's just not an issue, and it really sharpens the things that are an issue, which are exactly these class things. What I liked about the show a lot is that it leans much more heavily on the more arbitrary class proxy distinctions, like the fact that Jack is the leader of the choir, like comes across as much more important than the class distinctions of his family and so on. Or like how cool the parents are, how cool the dad is, all that kind of stuff. So it feels like the show is very, very focused on showcasing the artificiality of the claims to power that the kids are resting on.
I sort of want to talk a little about the other versions. I was shown the 1963 version in school. I think when we read it, we watched the movie and I thought I remembered it being good, but like the part that I watched, I
The acting was terrible.
I don't know if you were thinking about cinematography and acting and whatnot when you were... How old were you when you watched it the first time?
I mean, 13 or whatever. Yeah, probably. It was just like a depiction. Yeah. That's, you know, it's nice to see a film depiction of whatever. Mm-hmm. Watched the movie of The Odyssey in school, too. Like, which was this terrible,
oh, wow,
hairy... The 70s, 80s, early 80s.
Watch a lot of movies in your English class.
I mean, yeah.
I did. I think that might be a hallmark of American education, if I'm being honest. Watch
no, it's the same for us. I was actually going to say that one of the reasons probably this thing is 4 hours long and is the shape that it is because it's probably designed to be screened in British classrooms for the next 20 years.
That's a really good point. That's a whole week of class right there.
Yeah, yeah. You pretend to have read the book, and I'll pretend to believe you.
Yeah. So as far as I'm concerned, this new version just makes the other two, like, they might as well not exist. I know the old one, it's like on HBO is like the Criterion, like, this is a classic. I don't know. Did you have any Lawrence snobby film school stuff about?
No, I mean, I don't have anything snobby. I do enjoy this far better than I've enjoyed any. And I've seen all those other movies. In preparing for this, I watched the older movies. As I was grading, we just got out of finals week. So as I was grading, I was watching had them on, brother. And they're terrible. Honestly, the 90 one is so much worse than the one from the 60s.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because they make it Americanized and it makes no sense. Like, it just does not jive.
And they have digital watches. They make it present day.
Yeah.
As of 1990.
That was so much worse. And I wasn't ready for that to be so much worse. However, I do wonder, and this is actually a question for Sarah, because Sarah is our literary expert here. Which one do you prefer more? Do you like this show better than the original book? Or do you think the original book is a little bit better?
I almost always prefer the book. But I thought that
I felt it coming.
No. I thought that the television show actually brought this book made it really relevant for now, which mm-hmm. I appreciated. Mm-hmm. But I still think the original source material is superior.
Al, what do you think?
This TV show is an adaptation of the book, and I don't think you can really think about it as its own thing in isolation from that. As an adaptation of the book, it's fantastic. I guess the more interesting question would be, would a show like this have been made if it wasn't an adaptation of a literary classic? Because it does seem fairly timely. It seems like something like this was in the ether.
But we get these retellings all the time. I mean, we've got just Yellow Jackets is...
You're right. Yeah, it's a trope, sort now, of, isn't it?
You know? Yeah, it's a trope,
yeah,
for sure.
It is.
We're wrapping up here, but maybe in our after talk, whoever can stick around, we can talk about some of the variations off this and anticipate our Survivor episode a little bit as a related piece of media. Those people are not, they have rules, you know, they have camera people. It's not really comparable, but it's evoking some tropes here.
A little bit. Yeah. But you're right. There are rules in Survivor.
Do they have a conch? I need to learn everything about the show. Do they have a conch?
Sound at the very beginning of the show, right at the beginning of the credits, is a conch sound.
There you go. I wouldn't mind seeing this show before reading the book. Let me answer that question. I think the book is, you know, going to be the literary classic and going to be timeless in a way that the show is perhaps not. But if there was a little suspense in the show and you actually didn't know what was going to happen, I just even wonder what that experience would be. I think it might make it cooler and seem less dragged out. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
If I were to watch the show before I read the book would pale in comparison, I think. Like, I just don't know if the book would stand up, because you watch the show, you see it realized, you see the interiority of the characters, and then you read the book, and you're like, well, where's the interiority? The show adds so much, I wonder if the book would stand up to it. I don't know.
But the book, though, is its own thing. It also adds so much, because you're not going to get all of the symbolism, you're not going to get all of the allegory, you're not going to get all of that, because it's a different medium.
It's one person's coherent vision, and there's something that is irreplaceable in artworks about that. Whereas a show, I mean, there's good and bad things about having a second thought about things, right? Even like The Walking Dead or something like that. Okay, that was one guy and his vision in the comic book, but then they had a lot more time, and Kirkman was even involved in thinking about that. Some of what was determined in The Walking Dead, the initial comic, was like,
I might only get to do one, a couple issues here. I better make things happen very quickly. Whereas the show, they knew like, okay, this is established property. We've got at least a whole season. We can bring in women to write the women's parts. We can, you know, you have so many advantages when you can really deliberate on something, but you know, that's counterbalancing against, I don't know. This was Golding's first novel.
Yep. It's his debut.
How long? It was definitely written over a couple years. So you could really...
And there was a huge cut, apparently, at the very beginning. I think he had like the whole background of why they were on the plane, how they got there. And I think his editor was like, no, we're cutting those first two chapters. We're going straight to the island.
This is why you listen to your editors.
Yeah, that, absolutely.
Because that absolutely. Is the correct decision.
That is the right choice.
I was wondering about how these kids got scattered around. Like what sort of...
That's a very good point.
What sort of plane crash distributes children throughout the jungle intact? Like, that's not how it worked in Lost.
It's actually very historically accurate. The planes that they flew at the time all had individual ejector seats and all the passengers, so.
Okay.
Thanks, Al, for that sci-fi. For that sci-fi
over that island.
That sci-fi reading hard science.
All right. There. So it's patreon.com/prettymuchpop if you want to hear us talk more about related media and anticipate what we're going to do and other things we've been experiencing. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, panelists. Bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Pretty Much Pop is part of the Partially Examined Life podcast network. Get more Pretty Much Pop at prettymuchpop.com. Get bonus content for every episode at patreon.com/prettymuchpop.